Hello and welcome to Radio Inqilab, a podcast focused on change makers who are working to educate, resolve, and change the complex systems within which we live. Radio Inqilab aims to bring voices to the forefront who have traditional as well as modern solutions for our planet, can share knowledge on how we take decisive action and live in harmony with each other and Mother Earth. In this time of chaos, disinformation, and negativity, Radio Inqilab seeks to focus on ideas that work and the positive impact they can have. My name is Rupande Mehta, and I come to you from Lenape Land in New Jersey.
Today, our guest is Professor Clint Carroll. Professor Carroll is an environmental social scientist with an emphasis on Native American and Indigenous studies. He teaches courses on environmental politics, Indigenous knowledge, and comparative geographies in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's an enrolled Cherokee Nation tribal citizen. In his free time, he likes to garden and otherwise spend time outdoors with his family. He lives in Longmont, Colorado, on the ancestral homelands of the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, and the Ute Nations. Clint, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. I'm really excited about our conversation today. So I want to start off by asking you about your career trajectory. I like to understand how people come into the work that they're doing today. So people who are listening understand not only from some perspective, but also chalk possible career paths for other people. So tell us a little bit about how did you get into the work that you're doing today?
Sure. That's a big question. I will try to be as brief as possible. I guess the short of it is, I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, but I was raised outside of the reservation and away from our community there. But I grew up in northern Texas, so the Dallas area. I'm a first generation college student, so I started off with kind of a rocky road in higher ed. And ended up taking some community college courses, which were really beneficial to me because the pressure of university was less, and I had some committed instructors and mentors there who saw my interest in working with people, languages. I was very interested in languages, and still am. And that's applied later in life to learning my indigenous language, Cherokee. But directed me to a program at the University of Arizona in anthropology, specifically the applied aspects of anthropology. And their historic and really groundbreaking American Indian Studies program. So I was fortunate enough to apply and get accepted, and I had that kind of passion that, for me, came from really finding what interested me in the world. And I had in the before community college had been fortunate to do some travel, and so I came in to the University of Arizona with that kind of renewed sense of direction. I was really lucky to be a part of a couple of projects as a paid intern as an undergraduate, and that entailed interviewing community folks in northern Mexico and the Bahamas, of all places. It was a wonderful opportunity to, at least in the Bahamas, to get to know some traditional fisher people, fishers, fishermen, and women. And understand their perspectives and their local knowledge that they had generated as people who are closely connected to their environment and to the ocean, in response to some proposed marine protected areas that the Bahamian government was putting forth. And so the idea was to incorporate and center local knowledge in our work as applied anthropologists. And so I garnered some amazing experiences, and I really wanted to figure out, how can I apply this experience and this kind of framework, again, that was centering social science approaches to environmental issues, privileging local knowledge and perspectives. And then, of course, informed by my other studies in American Indian studies there. How can I apply this back home? And by home, I mean kind of in the broadest sense, my tribal community in northeastern Oklahoma, the Cherokee Nation. And so that led me to, ask some mentors of mine, one of whom is a Creek and Cherokee person. He was a professor there. He's an emeritus, so retired. His name is Tom Holm, and he helped put me in touch with some people back home who he knew, who were heading up and working with the environmental programs for the Cherokee Nation. That led to conversations with the current director and then director. She's been working for the tribe for quite some time, I think well over 30 years. And her name is Nancy John. She's been an incredible supporter and mentor of mine. She's like an auntie to me. She's actually Creek and Choctaw, but has worked for the Cherokee Nation, like I said, for decades. And she proposed a project that was based on some of the interests that I had and the experience that I had garnered as an undergraduate research assistant. And that kind of launched the questions that would inform my work up until this day and the questions, but also I think more importantly, the relationships. So she put me on a project that was having to do with understanding the impacts that were posed to Cherokee culturally significant plants. By development activities that spanned from the state of Oklahoma's activities, as well as things that the Cherokee Nation does and that are continually important. So, for example, road improvement in rural areas is important act of creating good infrastructure and transportation for our community members. But in the case of understanding how those activities would impact culturally significant plants, there was kind of a gap. So I had the fortune to go out and as a part of this job for the tribe, start building relationships with elders and knowledge keepers, who at first were kind of skeptical of me as someone who didn't grow up there and was kind of reconnecting. But over time, and I started my graduate program the following fall, so that was during the summer. But I kept going back during the summers and picking up where I left off. And over time, people started getting to know me and understanding that I wasn't there just as a fleeting, interested person, but that I had some long-term commitments, or at least that's kind of what they assumed. And so, that whole act of relationship building and gaining trust and continuing to work on this project led to the development of a longstanding program that sought to connect this cultural element of knowledge and relationship to the natural world and the tribal programs that are tasked with protecting our lands and environment. Which often, have inherited the bureaucracy and the structures of the federal government. So that was kind of the big dissertation research question is why is this happening in that way? And what can we do as Cherokee people to continue to have these dialogues about bridging that divide? So that's I'll have to stop there because I know I'm going long-winded here, but that's really what kind of drove me to continue this work, and that was back in 2004. And so it's been a good 15 plus years that I've been working on this project and sustaining these meaningful relationships with our elders as well as our tribal resource managers.
Wow, that's so interesting. Quite a trajectory from community college all the way to kind of asking these big questions and sustaining yourself with them over the past 20 or so years. You talked about a lot of things, but I picked up on some of the stuff. You talked about going to the Bahamas. Like, I would never think of going to the Bahamas for, studies like that. I guess it's so commercialized that you don't think about it as much. But I think the one thing that you talked about that really kind of struck me is centering local knowledge. And you said you learned that in the Bahamas, but you wanted to kind of apply in the Cherokee Nation as well to see how you can use the local knowledge. Talk to me a little bit about why that is important. On the surface of it, we understand that that is required, but And I you talked about the development of roads, which kind of hinted a little bit that you were showing that relationship, why centering local knowledge and developing roads, you kind of made a little bit of connection. But talk to me a little bit more about what do you think is the relationship? Why do you need to make sure that the people who are aware of the things that they have seen around them tell us before we go about and do these other things in that area?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're somewhat of a there's a kind of a contrast in each situation or in each context, and I'll explain in a second. But I mean, the fundamental answer to that is, so much of the decisions that governments make are posed from this top-down approach, and that flies in the face of the local experiences, knowledge, relationships that communities have with very, very familiar and intimate connections with local landscapes. And so that's a tenet of a couple of different fields. One, environmental anthropology that I was focusing on in my undergraduate, and then later in my PhD studies at UC Berkeley, political ecology as well, which is very closely related to environmental anthropology. There are these emphases on how local people, whether you want to say indigenous peoples, people who are local, quote unquote resource users, but people who have nonetheless developed connections to and therefore knowledge of through their practices, their environmental practices, whether that be agricultural, harvesting wild plants and medicines, hunting, all of these activities that create a sense of tacit knowledge, of knowledge that is not based in ecological theories, but is based in practice. And that really is the kind of fundamental approach that we took for our work when it came to interviewing and learning from Bahamian fishers. And that was in relation to the proposed marine protected areas, which are acts of conservation. So, we see this as something that, at least from this applied environmental anthropology or political ecology approach, as something that's necessary to ensure the success of these types of proposals. On the flip side, you mentioned my comment about roads. You've got development activities, and I think by and large, I would like to kind of distinguish these activities clearly. To give you a little bit more context, when it comes to tribal programs that are trying to create infrastructure or just healthy living environments for disenfranchised populations like Native American, American Indian peoples throughout the United States, and are doing so, but with also the eye to not make matters worse environmentally. And so it's this kind of tension of how do our programs, projects, activities that that do entail quote unquote development, so for example, improving or building new roads is the example that I use, but this could also have to do with a multitude of different, tribal development projects. But how do we, reconcile that with kind of ancestral understandings of our relationship to the land as native peoples? And those are some of the conundrums that every tribe has their own answer and approach to, but for me, what was apparent was, and what my colleagues in Indigenous studies, critical Indigenous studies, and I are continuing to think about, was that the complexity of these so-called or tensions, if you will, is actually worth understanding and worth really studying and talking to people about, because in fact, as I worked through my dissertation and later the book, Cherokee people have been having these dialogues for quite some time. These differing understandings of our connection and relationship to land are important to highlight because it shows the complexity, the density of native communities and native nations, as opposed to this kind of monolithic or even romanticized vision that everybody agrees with one another, and for that matter, everybody is innately and inherently connected to the land in this kind of spiritual or romantic way. And so, my work is getting at, not only kind of trying to break up those stereotypes, but also understanding, what are people talking about, and what really does matter, and how can we sift through these very vexing and complicated issues in ways that ultimately, arrives at a sense of, okay, this may be a way to relate to the land as Cherokee people, as diverse as that word can mean. There are all kinds of Cherokee people in the world in terms of their political leanings, in terms of their upbringing, et cetera, et cetera. But how can we arrive at a sense of this is what it means to relate to the land as Cherokee people, despite all of that? And that's kind of really what informs my work is seeing that reflected through both a bureaucratic angle and kind of a sense of, for example, tribal resource managers who have to navigate systems and structures that aren't of our own making. Oftentimes, like I said, they're often modeled on federal, US-based, AKA colonial systems and structures, but are nevertheless doing their best to kind of work with that system to benefit Cherokee people in our lands, as well as traditional elders, people who grew up with a very different outlook on the world and can offer that perspective and knowledge. And often that's encoded in our language. And so, how do you straddle these different worlds and yet, work together toward a common goal?
Yeah, I have a question for you on that later, but you mentioned your book, so let's talk about your book.
Sure.
So in your book, Roots of Our Renewal, you talk about how Cherokee people have developed material, spiritual, and political ties with the lands that they've inhabited since removal from their homelands in the southeastern United States, despite devastating consequences. So talk to me a little bit about what was the key to their success and what can we take from it in our time today when there's so much change happening, especially, climate change.
Yeah, that became quite a central question for me, and I really leaned heavily on looking at some of the oral accounts, so oral history, and that's been recorded. I mean, primarily through the Doris Duke papers and the Indian Pioneer papers, which are housed at the Oklahoma Historical Society. And reading these accounts of Cherokee people who had lived and seen, the reservation, which, at that time, that they were being interviewed had been terminated, if you will, not quite terminated, I shouldn't say that word, but it had been ignored by the creation of the state of Oklahoma in 1907. But nonetheless, like, hearing, or excuse me, reading and envisioning what these folks were saying about their experiences. And then going further back into kind of political history, the many works that have been written about the Trail of Tears and the removal policy, which happened in 1838, 1839, even going back before that and reading and understanding Cherokee migration, pre removal policies, so what people often refer to as the old settlers, or the Western Cherokees who migrated in advance of the Trail of Tears, really trying to get this understanding of what migration, whether it was in advance of the forced removal, or as a result of the Trail of Tears and Andrew Jackson's policy, what Cherokee people thought of when they were leaving their homelands and establishing new connections to place. And more recently, I've worked to kind of go back to some of those accounts, and I've taken up a couple of stories that really stuck out to me that people told about their relationships to place through animals and through animal teachers. And I've compared and contrasted those stories to some of our older stories, our ancient stories that talk about these animals as the representations of some of our clans within our matrilineal clan system. And all of that's to say, through this kind of just deep, like sitting with and thinking about, what Cherokee people were or could have been thinking during that time. The phrase that came to mind to describe this process of relating to a new land was relational continuity, because something that became apparent to me was that Cherokee people, as I said earlier, are such, I mean, it's such a diverse nation. It's such a diverse community or tribe, if you will. But there are certain elements of continuity that, cultures change, right? But our relationship, the way that we understand ourselves in relation to other beings and to the land itself, has some constants, has some continuity to it. And that's what became apparent to me, during that time that I was writing the book. And then later, as I was kind of revisiting these questions through the lens of our relationships with animals, specifically deer and mountain lions. And so it's just one of those things that to me speaks a lot about, it speaks to some of the, I guess, received notions about indigeneity that exceed what most people may think of when they think of, indigenous peoples. They, at least as we are portrayed by others, bound in place, connected to the land, again, going back to like disrupting these romanticized notions, but emphasizing that indigenous peoples move and have moved and have had expansive relationships with land, including their own territories, but as well as with others, for millennia. And we can't continue to think that, as the colonial governments writ large would like to say, you are indigenous to this place and you belong here, and this is all that you will ever know. There's so much more to thinking outside that box. And so, I'm drawing on other people's work as well in thinking through this, but that's kind of what it says to me, and also what it means today that, there are ways of understanding indigeneity that are important to value as kind of central. And of course, connection to land is one of them. But what happens when you're uprooted? You can still be connected to land. You can still have meaningful relationships that are informed by continual knowledge building and knowledge production, if you will, that is traditional as much as it is to, for example, our relationships to our homeland, which continue and persist to this day. They're relatively not that far away. However, they are, they're still hard to get to when it comes to, they're not right next door. But we have the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina who remained and are a federally recognized tribe, and our tribe, the Cherokee Nation, and then the third federally recognized tribe, the United Kituwa Band, who also reside in Oklahoma and the Cherokee Reservation. All three of those tribes still meet regularly and talk to each other. And a lot of that work has to do with also emphasizing our language. So we have a language consortium that comes together. And so my point is that we still have relationships with our homelands, but we've managed to also continue our existence as an indigenous nation in a place that is not our original homeland. And so that's kind of the significance for me. And there's a lot of other things I could talk about with regard to, as you said, climate change, but maybe I can revisit that in a future answer.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So they, you know, whatever happened, obviously being uprooted from where they were was a bad thing. But because they had the relationship to the land, they were able to apply those set of skills to another land and be able to kind of prosper in that way. There's so much to learn from that, right? But I think the basic thing that I took from that is learn to listen to the land, and the
Yeah.
land will tell you how to survive.
That's a beautiful way of summing that up. Thank you for that. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, so you talked a little bit about matrilineal cultures earlier. So I want to specifically ask you with respect to the Cherokee Nation and what you've seen. They have the medicine keepers, and the role of women is very prominent in that. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah,
Yeah,
well,
well
the Cherokee Nation medicine keepers came out of these relationships and conversations that I was having with elders and knowledge keepers, and my supervisor at the time as well, who had been very much a part of this dialogue. His name is Pat Gwynn, and recently retired from the Cherokee Nation, but also 30 plus years of service to the tribe and a key actor and partner in this work. The origin of the group came about 4 years after we started working in 2004. So they solidified as a group in 2008. And the story of that is, we had been interviewing and speaking to people as individuals, but Pat and I had started to ask ourselves, there was interest, clearly there was a little bit of momentum, but how do we really kind of jumpstart this and not only keep it moving, but generate more confidence from people? And the reason why I say confidence is that for Cherokee people and many indigenous peoples, talking about plants and specifically their medicinal uses and the knowledge of that tends to be something that people don't really openly discuss. Especially with outsiders. There was also some apprehension about, what does this mean if I were to give you this information, this knowledge? You're working for the tribe, even though it's an indigenous, bureaucracy, it's still a bureaucracy, and there's no way I can ensure that the tribe or the nation can treat it respectfully, or have the proper protections, for example. So there were these hesitations, and that's founded and based in decades, generations of the misuse of Indigenous knowledge, the exploitation, and even on the flip side, the ridicule of Indigenous knowledge. And so, Pat and I put our heads together and we said, well, what if we got all these people together and they got to see each other? And that's when, in October of 2008, we worked to call together these individuals, and it really kind of created this or ignited this spark, and thus began the Cherokee Medicine Keepers. And their mission is twofold: one, to perpetuate our knowledge, specifically the knowledge of plants, but also to protect the lands and encourage indigenous-led or Cherokee-led conservation projects. And as a result of those two pronged goals, it took some time, took a lot of deliberation to think about how this group would organize itself. But this is kind of illuminating a microcosm of what I said earlier. How do you incorporate as a group, but also not lose that sense of Cherokee-ness or indigenousness? And so there were some guiding conversations that we had with a spiritual leader and elder. His name was Crosland Smith. He sadly passed away in February of this year. He's a dear friend and elder of mine, and was incredibly influential to this group and to their success, and again served as a spiritual advisor and leader. But he said, if we look at, the way that Cherokee people, the way that Cherokee culture thinks about coming together, and the power of coming together, that includes a an acknowledgement that hierarchy, which we can make the argument is inherent to patriarchy, a sense of hierarchical roles and rules and structure, is not what we look to. We look to what he would call, or what he called, divine equality. And the way he phrased that in Cherokee was galankti igatiha, so everything being equal in a divine way. And I think his teachings, and having the privilege to continue to work with him throughout that time, and up till the end of his life when he crossed over, I've worked with him on three published books that talk about these ideals of Cherokee governance, if you will, but that emphasize the importance of women in that. Of course, going back to the fundamental structure of Cherokee society, as it was pre-colonial times, and even today, at the ceremonial grounds, as our clan system is matrilineal. So, you inherit your clan from your mother, generally. And that governs the actions that occur during a ceremony because of the importance that women hold in that arena of Cherokee culture and life. It also connects to how we understand our relationship to land. And I think that's really important too, because, pre-colonial times and up until really the birth of the Cherokee constitutional form of government, it was the women who determined what happened to Cherokee land. So I think that's profound in the sense of connecting the work that we're doing today to our understandings of how we govern and how we ideally envision leadership and decision making being in the hands of women, but also how that directly applies to the projects and goals of revitalizing knowledge and our relationship to land, as centering a matrifocal or more kind of women-centered approach. And I say that, and I'm kind of speaking on my own there, because I can theorize based on my experiences and conversations, but I see that as inherent in, if you will, and I don't mean to essentialize here, but I see it as inherent in some of the goals of our more recent project, which is a land education program with five Cherokee youth. The curriculum was developed, and we carried out the project in partnership with the Medicine Keepers as the teachers, the advisors, the leaders of this program. But we had four tenets or principles, and each one of them articulated a way of understanding this work that was in opposition, and maybe not in kind of overt opposition, some of it was, but certainly in contrast to a Western, quote unquote, way of operating in the world. And so when I say Western, I can equivocate that to patriarchal, heteropatriarchal, to be more specific,
Or
colonial.
European,
Yeah,
colonial European.
European, yes. And so, even if folks haven't articulated explicitly this point, I think that land education curriculum that we developed together also contained this, again, my own words, but kind of more feminist understanding of, indigenous feminist understanding of our relationship to each other, to the land, and to such a program, which was an educational program. And so, it was flying in the face of, it was contrasting with a lot of the experiences that the elders, the medicine keepers, had as children, going through the boarding school system, which, it's It wasn't that long ago that it ended. So their generation had experienced that. And that was absolutely patriarchal, and that was absolutely colonial. And so, wanting to very intently not replicate that experience for Cherokee youth coming through this program. So anyway, that's my take on that question. I've been extremely blessed to work with the Medicine Keepers, and their membership, it has fluctuated, and sadly, some of that has to do with people passing away. And so, in terms of the makeup of the group, I believe it's majority female, if I'm not mistaken. But like I said, it's kind of fluctuated. People at this point in time, we are grateful for those who are a part of the group and who have that knowledge and want to share it. And so, as far as creating a structure that models a more matrilineal or models some of the older forms of our governance, sense of governance, we haven't gotten to that point yet. It's a pretty, I wouldn't say loosely organized, but certainly it's based on let's do the work, and let's try to fulfill this twofold mission as best we can, and while we can. So anyway, I'll stop there.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall, some of these programs that you have, and just absorb everything you're talking about, because everything just seems, I don't want to make it sound, like idyllic, because there are differences, that things come up, people are people, and there's always going to be sort of, back and forth. But on the basic level, it sounds like how what is missing from our lives, right? And I, while you were talking about the medicine, the work and the work of the women and so forth, I kept thinking about our recent, political woes that are going on here in the United States with the election coming up and with Kamala Harris being the nominee and so forth. And while I don't want to make this political, I do. Everything is political. So it's I specifically want to touch on this, that it's not just about having a woman in place and then making sure, that your box is checked. It's that's not what you're talking about, because you said it's majority female. So chances are, there are some men in that circle as well. But this is more about the ideas and how we are working, or you are working to normalize, as you said, non-European, non-patriarchal standards of living and evolving. And that's what it is about. It's not so much about just about the gender of the person. Am I correct in assuming that?
I would say absolutely. It's, I mean, I think the way that I've been thinking about this, and really kind of alluding back to some of my the first points that I was making is how do we continue to function as contemporary Indigenous nations, but not necessarily buy into the structures that we have to work within, and that can be tricky. Because there are navigations and negotiations that are at play that are complex. But how do we honor that fundamental connection to land, which, as I said, is based, at least from Cherokee people's perspectives, in this kind of original way as being connected to the clan system and connected to our mothers and a matrilineal understanding of governance and leadership. Now, it wasn't to say that men didn't have a role, and still continue to not have a role. They very much do, and that's evident in multiple arenas of life for Cherokee people today and in the past. But yeah, like who do you turn to for those decisions, and who do you turn to? What type of approach are you making when considering these types of very complex decisions, and it's not to say that it's perfect today by any means. I think the Medicine Keepers are this kind of anomaly, if you will, in the way that the tribe is having to negotiate and navigate, like I said, these structures and systems that aren't set up for this. And so there, I won't get into the nitty-gritty, as you mentioned, the politics of it all, but I mean there have been some tensions over time, and but what's more interesting to me is how they unfold and what happens, and understanding and observing that. And I allude to some of them. I actually go into some detail in the book, stories and instances where the medicine keepers have, in their fulfilling, or in their in seeking to fulfill their mission, have run into some tensions. But like I said, it's about how they're resolved. That's more interesting to me, because I think we know that it's much more complex than to say we need to abolish our relationship with the federal government, or not work with bureaucracy. It's much more complex than that. And so what do we do in the meantime? I mean, these are alluding to much bigger questions than I think you ask them later on, but or you allude to them in the questions that you signaled to me earlier, about decolonization and settler colonialism. But that's my take on it as a community-based scholar and someone who is invested in Indigenous futures, but also is very interested in the day-to-day acts of governance that still prioritize our people and the land, and have that kind of that alternative perspective to offer when it comes to governance and nation building and all that stuff.
Yeah, and the alternative knowledge to offer has worked for thousands of years, so probably a good idea to pay attention to some of that.
Yeah.
Let me take you, sorry, were you going to say something?
No, please go ahead.
Okay, but let me take you back to climate change then. So we, talked a little bit about it, and you said you would elaborate on that. So what is the Cherokee Nation doing to counter the impact of climate change? We touched on it a little bit, listening to the land, of course, being the primal way of sort of understanding, but in specific, anything that you'd like to share in terms of how they're tackling with this problem?
Well, yeah, I mean, the projects that I'm most involved in have to do with Indigenous-led conservation. And then, like I alluded to earlier, land education. So another way of putting that, or another way that others have put that, is community based resurgence projects. And it's a way of describing and talking about projects that seek to reconnect to our knowledge systems, to center our knowledge systems in that process, to encourage youth and elders, so intergenerational teaching and interactions. So learning from the land, learning from each other in ways that are fundamentally guided by our Indigenous values, and in this case, of course, Cherokee values. And so I see that. So to kind of hit on the former point, Indigenous-led conservation, we've been working on a couple of different fronts. One, we've been working with the Medicine Keepers and the student cohort who I mentioned, as well as the Secretary of Natural Resources Office for the Cherokee Nation, to establish a first ever Medicine Keepers Preserve, which is a conservation area in within the Cherokee Nation Reservation. It's about 800 to 900 acres in eastern Adair County, which kind of butts right up against the current state of Arkansas. And it's this beautiful place that we've actually been meeting with the elders at, and the students, for quite some time. And it was established as a preserve, I believe, in 2022, officially. It's one instance of, okay, well, this, what does this mean? Well, it means it's not going to be subject to leasing, which many of our lands we've inherited this policy or this practice of leasing out tribal lands as a source of revenue to cattle operations, which has its own kind of well, a whole bunch of issues going on there in terms of, what does the land look like? How is it managed to create grazing land for cattle, which often flies in the face of the ways that Cherokee people use the land for medicine, hunting, plants, etc. As well as some of the historic, which haven't continued for quite some time, but are still a part of the legacy that we inherited. But BIA, and when I say BIA, it's Bureau of Indian Affairs, so the federal government, policies of clear cutting old growth forests of oak, hickory, and planting loblolly pines, again, using that as a source of revenue, which, as many of us know, the BIA woefully, horribly mismanaged tribal resources and revenues for quite some time, for decades. But those are the programs that we inherited. So this act of leasing out our tribal lands for these two types of practices, and this parcel is designated as an area that will not be touched in that way, and is emphasized as a place to for the medicine keepers and those who they are teaching, and those who are affiliated with our programs to be able to go and be in that place. And something that is different from mainstream conservation models, to be in relationship to it. So to gather plants, to make medicine, to be on the land in ways that honors our own traditions and practices and knowledges. So that's one front, if you will. The other is working with agencies like the National Park Service, which, as I alluded to just a second ago, has a very different structure and history of formation, and often entails the concept of take only pictures, leave only footprints. So the formation of many of the national parks today was built on the back of Native peoples who were dispossessed from those places. However, more recently, some individuals within the Park Service have been working to change that. And so we've been partnering with some of them in line with a federal rule that I think came out in 2013, 2012. Forgive me if I'm missing the mark there. But it enables tribes to establish gathering agreements with national parks. So we started work on this back in 2014, and this was a gathering agreement that we made with Buffalo National River, which, again, kind of alluding back to what I was referring to before with our the distance between Cherokee people and our original homelands, which are in present-day North Carolina, northern Georgia, eastern Tennessee, the southern Appalachian Mountains, basically. Buffalo National River is a fraction of the distance from our homelands. It's about 3.5 hours away from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which is our tribal capital, and yet supports a lot of the plants that Cherokee people know as medicine and have experienced a shortage of within the reservation in recent decades due to climate change, due to increased drought and extreme weather events. Cherokee people have been noticing a lack of access to a decline in the population of certain plants that they used to rely on for medicine. So establishing this agreement with Buffalo National River has opened up an opportunity for Cherokee people to continue to sustain those traditions and those practices, and do so in ways that doesn't require a 10-hour or 12-hour ride to the homelands. And further is, the irony, I guess, if you will, is that even though the national park system often required the dispossession of native peoples, and so its kind of very foundation is problematic. You witness, as in the within the Cherokee Reservation, these lands being subjected to many lands in the Ozarks, for that matter, being subjected to land clearing, development, cattle grazing, other agricultural uses. So again, despite that kind of troubled past of the park system, we have Buffalo National River, which is, has managed to create a place where those plants can continue to grow. And I would say, furthermore, Cherokee people, as a part of this gathering agreement, have the opportunity to inform the management of those lands within the park. So I would say, to kind of, take this a step further, it's not only about protecting lands in the way of what we call fortress conservation, enclosing lands and moving people out, and then continuing to keep people out as far as, being able to use plants and other beings within that park. But this has an opportunity for indigenous knowledge, when appropriate and when Cherokee people choose to do so, to inform the management of the park to ensure the health of those very plants that they are seeking to gather. So, I think that that says a lot for, what the tribe is doing and what the medicine keepers are doing to, as a reaction to climate change. I think the other element to that a lot of people may not be able to c directly connect the dots, but to me is evident, is these community-based resurgence projects are all about doing the work that is in contrast to the practices, policies, mindsets that have built up and contributed to the climate crisis today. So, how do we, as Native people, design programs that instill knowledge in our young people and younger generations that doesn't center colonial ways of understanding the relationship between humans and the natural world, capitalist ways of understanding that relationship? So, exploitative, extractivist, again, going back to our previous conversation, patriarchal, hierarchical. All of these kind of forms of domination that have led to the current crisis, how do we push back against that? And I could also point to some things that our tribe is doing, the Cherokee Nation, that are kind of more legible, like to the mainstream environmentalist movement, or climate activist movement. So, installing a excuse me, electric vehicle for our tribal employees, emphasizing recycling and all this stuff. But to me, what's more important and more significant is, what are we doing to create and nurture, excuse me, nurture and revitalize and sustain our indigenous ways of understanding the relationship between human beings and the natural world? And how can that serve as a model, as an example for others who, maybe, electric vehicles are a great thing. And I know that there's a lot of complexity within that argument, for sure, but that's not the only answer. And I think that going back to our understandings of this fundamental relationship, has a lot to teach the world at the same time. And so, it's about finding that balance between, cultivating this within our own community, and then, dialoguing as a community to figure out what are the things that need to be broadcasted and need to be shared with others, so that they can inform our approach to the climate crisis in some of those more fundamental ways that, that don't entail the kind of surface level and I guess you could say, legible more legible approaches that mainstream environmentalists may say.
Yeah, it's not clear cut, right? It's the mainstream environmental movement is fraught with so many contradictions. You talked about EVs, and on the surface, in theory, concept sounds great, but when you actually look into how they're deriving the materials that are needed for it and the mining that they have to do, which is again going back to your earlier point, it's extractive, it's patriarchal, it's capitalistic. Whether it's in Congo or it's in Sudan or it's in native on native land that is sacred, again, it goes back to having to go into the ground and dig for more stuff. So it's not without its demerits, so to speak, and it's not so clearly defined in terms of whether it's pure or non-pollutive. Some of the things that you suggested seem to be more sort of clearly defined in terms of not being extractive in that sense, and it's more sort of revitalizing these spaces that have suffered so much because of the extractive policy. So that definitely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, when we kind of take ourselves out of the, I guess, the presumption that everything must operate within a dominant, whatever you want to call it, capitalist, extractivist mindset, to me, that's when the other, well, the alternatives start making much more sense. And start becoming the imperatives that we have to really consider in this day that we live in. So, yeah, that's what gets me, well, simultaneously impassioned and frustrated is that, making those connections can sometimes be very difficult when that mindset is so ingrained in people and the idea of an alternative economic or social framework is completely out of the question, or even without out of the realm of possibility. But as I said, the part that makes me hopeful and passionate about this work is that obviously Cherokee people aren't the only ones doing it. So I'm thinking with, I'm dialoguing with and learning from other communities and talking with the elders about different ideas. I'm a part of a amazing grant project that is based in Canada, but is helping to fund and support Indigenous land-based projects all over the world. I can certainly give you the link to this for listeners to learn more about it, but it's the grant is a word that is indigenous to people from Mali, so it's an indigenous language from Mali, the Tuareg people. It's called Aramat, and it's a way of understanding health and biodiversity as being interconnected. So human health, landscape health, aka biodiversity, are one in the same. And so this grant project is as I said run out of a university in Canada, and I'm fortunate to be a part of it as someone who has been a part of those conversations to develop the proposal and to learn from the projects that they have been supporting has been really eye-opening as well. So, how are other Indigenous communities addressing these issues that get to this fundamental understanding that we are connected to the land and so is our health, and vice versa?
I think the part that really gets me aggravated is, we don't believe ourselves to be part of the circle.
Hmm.
I think we're above the circle. And that's when we try to control the circle, is when everything goes wrong. And that's again going back to the patriarchal mindset that they're not even ready to think about it. I mean, the concept that it's connected is so obvious anywhere you look, you're that you are part of this. If
you take yourself out, it'll probably do much better on its own. Without humans, we don't, we need Earth. Earth does not need us. So it's kind of one of those things. But with excellent work like you are doing and so many others are doing, as you've mentioned, hopefully we'll get closer to that idea very soon.
Yeah, that it can be it can be an easy pitfall of thought is that, humans writ large are horrible to the earth. But as many in critical indigenous studies and folks on the ground, people who still know and live their traditional knowledge can attest, like it really begs the question, which human, like which type of human is really terrible? And it's not to get into identity politics, but it's fundamentally asking the question, what mindset, what mind frame are you coming from? That's what I mean by which type of human. Is it an extractive type of human, or is it a human that is in good relationship with the land around them? And it doesn't mean that it's an either or. I'm not trying to be a purist here and say that. I mean, I'm as much entrapped in some of the workings of capitalism as anyone else. And I try to work my way around things and develop a relationship to land in the best way that I can. And some of that is also a privileged thing, to have a garden, to have a space to grow food. So I acknowledge all of that. I'm not trying to kind of draw artificial lines in the sand or say that if you're not this way, then you're doomed. But I think it does prompt critical thinking, and the necessity of critical thought is to understand, like, when we're talking about humans being a bad thing for the planet, we have to be more specific. And those are the systems and structures that I think get taken for granted, at least in, mainstream culture, if you will, that we need to question. So.
I completely agree. Completely agree. We've talked a little bit about this, but let's kind of talk a little more, I guess. You've written a lot about settler colonialism, and in your experience, and you just a few minutes ago, you said it's impossible to live without the trappings when you're in the system. We do our best to navigate it, but there are still times that, you get it. Even you talked about the BIA and how you have to work with them. So I'm saying all that to kind of say it's really very difficult, if not impossible, to live, like a purist, like you mentioned in your words. But there are some ways that we can still, kind of fight it on a daily basis, or I don't want to sound like, fight as a negative word, but more sort of like be able to live your life without it on a daily basis. What are some of the ways that we can do that?
Well, I mean, yeah, so it's when we're speaking about colonialism and settler colonialism specifically, it's a concept that can be easily kind of made into a monolith, and therefore in the process, kind of the specifics, the details of what exactly colonialism is can get lost. And as a result, it can kind of appear, depending on where you're coming from, who you are, like hopeless. How can we possibly stop this monolithic structure that has been, built up over centuries? And the same goes for other structures like capitalism. And so these are some areas of thought that inevitably come up in many of my classes and in my own mind on a daily basis. And I think that the best answer for me is to, break them down into their constituent parts. And so make them less daunting, make them more flawed, and understand what are the holes and then what are the possibilities there. And I'm drawing from others who are thinking about this too, in terms of decolonial thinkers and theorists, And so that's inspirational to me as far as like understanding other movements and how they've considered themselves in the face of ongoing colonialism like the Zapatistas. And you know, when we start understanding where are the holes, and also what are the constituent parts that make up colonialism as it exists today, that's when it gets really helpful as a thought project. And so recently, I can point to an amazing report that came out locally here in Colorado. It's called the Truth, Restoration, and Education Commission Report of Colorado. And it was spearheaded by a nonprofit called People of the Sacred Land, based in Denver. And it talks about it, it details in a painstaking fashion. The treaties that were agreed upon, granted, oftentimes tribal leaders were, to use a legal term, under duress, so the power dynamics weren't equal by any means. But it's also worth saying that the treaties were there, and in many cases have been broken, and so leading to, illegal land taking, so land theft. As well as, you know, the coinciding with acts of dispossession, indigenous dispossession. And then, you know, built upon that act of dispossession, the garnering of billions and billions of dollars of, you know, as you alluded to before, you know, mining, mineral resources and revenue from that, those activities, you know, other things that were, you know, economic benefits that were built upon, you know, stolen land. And so it's one thing to say, you know, here's a, this is colonial and we need to be decolonial. But it's another thing to say, this is colonial and what is that exactly? And how can we work with people to, and you know, a lot of this is education, as the report says very directly. And so that absolutely coincides with my day job, you know, and I think that's a huge part of the picture is like, how can we educate? How can we, you know, if we are speaking to in this very privileged space, you know, of the academy, if we're speaking to people who, you know, want to know, so we have them as a, and I'm saying this facetiously, but as the captive audience, you know, my students who I always love thinking with and brainstorming and problem solving and theorizing about these huge questions. How can we arm people to go out into the world and be able to as you say, fight, but also, you know, challenge the status quo? You know, understanding the history of how things came to be is one approach. Understanding, as I've been saying previously, how to think outside that mindset, you know, drawing from our traditional perspectives and our visionary indigenous thinkers that go back, you know, centuries, you know, that we draw upon in critical indigenous studies. That's another approach. And then, you know, understanding the current workings, you know, how do, you know, how does conservation work? You know, what is a conservation easement? What is a land trust? You know, how can we work toward land back in ways that, you know, acknowledge, yeah, the ideal situation is that tomorrow all indigenous lands are returned to their rightful owners. But we know that the reality is much more complex than that. So how can we work toward that in ways that, you know, again, it may entail navigating structures, legal, political, and otherwise, that will still work toward the fundamental goal of you know, indigenous lands rematriated or you know, returned. So yeah, that's a big question, and it's tough to answer succinctly, but I think, you know, going back to our previous conversation around decolonization, or around colonialism being a root factor of the current climate crisis, I think that is key to understanding. It's key to drawing those connections and thinking about these very rooted, deep-seated, sources of the crisis that we're experiencing today, and then helping to break that apart and making it more, reasonable as something to take on. That's what motivates me, because I'm as affected by that thinking as anyone else. And I think, my students, like I said, this comes up very frequently in class, can get discouraged, and in doing so can feel despair versus hope. So the hope is what is the everyday, is the little things that you can work on. And in my realm, it just happens to be education and providing students with tools, and then, in my community work, doing it in ways that have tangible and practical outcomes for Native people back home.
Yeah, it's definitely a big question, but I think at the heart of it, and just based off of our conversation for the past hour, I think it's the one thing that I can definitely conclude is this is all related. Because you're talking about climate change, you cannot talk about that without talking about capitalism. You cannot talk about that without talking about patriarchy or about settler colonialism. It's kind of all of these things are, part of a circle that the bad circle, I guess. That need to be tackled or looked at together. And I think that's what you probably meant when you said break it up into its parts and look at it that way. And then you can kind of tackle one at a time via education, via land restoration, land back and all of those things. So it's definitely can't look at it in isolation. Just have to make sure that you're looking at it together.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Clint, you've been great. I really enjoyed our conversation. My last question for you, which I usually close out the podcast with, is give us three resources to learn more about your work.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to share some recent and longstanding resources with you and with the audience. More recently, a segment came out on one of our Cherokee Nation production platforms. It's the venue, or the production company, is called OCO TV, and I can provide a link to that for you. But OCO is how we say hello in Cherokee, and so it's really an amazing production that has, I mean, I think it's 9 seasons in the making. It's won many awards. I think most recently there was a regional Emmy award, a set of awards. I think it scooped them up this year. So I'm very excited that the Medicine Keepers and our work were featured in a segment on season 8 of that program. But I can certainly provide the link if people want to watch that. It's a pretty brief. I think it's about 10 minutes long, but it. Folks will be able to see some of the people I'm talking about and hear from them directly. Another one is something that I've been very proud of for since it came out in 2015, and it's a result of a photo voice project that the Medicine Keepers and I undertook together. And what a photo voice project is that it entails a small community or a group of people who are essentially rallying around a couple of themes that are meaningful to them, and they take pictures of what to them kind of convey those themes. And so we back in 2015 designed a photo voice project around land and health, and the relationship between land and health. And the Medicine Keepers went out and took photos, and then I interviewed them after receiving their photos. And then compiled everything into a still image documentary with voiceovers and some background sound and music. And so it's about a 30-minute long production that I was just, as I said, just really overjoyed to be a part of and to help facilitate with them. And so that's another one where you can hear directly from the elders, their perspectives, and it's called Cherokee Voices for the Land. That's available on YouTube with their permission, so you can search it up and watch it there. And then lastly, I send you the link to our website for the grant project that we've been working on, that has been supporting us with the land education curriculum and program that we've been running, as well as with the ongoing research that I'm doing with Cherokee communities that centers on access to land and the politics of that, and how Cherokee people are navigating a very fragmented landscape politically in terms of land ownership, as well as how climate change impacts people's ability to get to plants to continue to practice these knowledge traditions and relationships with the natural world. That project closed out in January, but we were generously funded by the National Science Foundation, specifically the Cultural Anthropology Program, Geographic and Information Systems Programs, and then the Endangered Languages Program. And I probably got the second program title wrong, but you get the gist. And I also have to mention that some great support has come from the Indian Land Tenure Foundation. They're based in Minnesota, but fund projects all over the US working with tribal communities to figure out ways to get tribal lands back into to native hands, and all kind of related issues, including supporting our land education program. So we've been fortunate to work with some amazing support from those entities. And yeah, we look forward to continuing this work into the future. But those are some resources that I direct people to give you some more knowledge, and people want to learn more about the work that we do.
Thank you so much. This has been a great time. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for taking the time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's wonderful. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to us today. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram at Radio InCollab. Until next time, Abjo.